Okay. And, begin this morning's talk. And as I might keep in my promises, that last night there was a question which I said will take a long talk, so I'm going to devote this morning's talk to that question, which is, can you please explain about the five controlling faculties, the indriyas? Very often in retreats I spent a talk explaining those five controlling faculties, simply because that they are what empower one's meditation. They're called controlling faculties. That's the literal meaning of indriya. Indriya is like a lord, like a controller, like a master. Because I've made a lot of emphasis in this retreat that you don't do the controlling, that you don't do the managing. There's some other force which actually leads the meditation into great depth and great stillness and great profundity and great happiness. And if you look at the causes which give power to meditation, it's these five controlling faculties. And sometimes it's interesting and it's useful to explain those as what empowers the meditation, because it takes the place of us, it takes the place of will, it takes the place of the doer, the controller, when we understand it's these five faculties that do the work for us. Not us, not me deciding what to do. And it gives the meditation a much deeper significance, and it makes it work much more efficiently. Because we find that if we really want to have the meditation going into deep, blissful, clear states, willpower is not the job. Willpower is not the point. Instead of putting all of the effort into getting a strong will, we put all the effort into developing these causes, the five controlling faculties. And for those of you who don't know what those five faculties are, it is the first one is faith or confidence, inspiration. The three little descriptions of the same word, faith, confidence, inspiration. And the second one is energy. And third is mindfulness, which I spoke about at length yesterday. And the fourth is this word samadhi, which is stages of letting go. Or, in another aspect of that word, the ability to sustain your attention, to hold something still for long periods of time. That's why sometimes it's called concentration. But concentration implies too much force and too much controlling. The best stillness comes from letting go, not from force. This is why I usually call samadhi states of letting go. But that's actually what causes samadhi, letting go. But the result of samadhi, how it manifests to the consciousness, is the ability to hold something for long periods of time without movement, without effort. That's called samadhi, sustained attention. And lastly, panya is like wisdom, seeing deeply into the nature of things, understanding what's going on, wisdom. Those are the five controlling faculties. Just in brief again, faith, confidence, inspiration, number one, number two, energy, number three, mindfulness, number four, samadhi, number five, wisdom. And so putting each one of those in its proper context in the meditation, we start with confidence, with faith, with inspiration. And I think you'll know that unless you have degree of confidence and faith that this is going to work, then you're basically wasting your time, because you don't really want to be here. When it comes to confidence and inspiration, I like to bring up the little story which has always helped me a lot in my meditation. Again, it's understanding what is actually control, how to get the best out of yourself and how to get the best out of other people, out of other monks. Because, you know, I'm in the position of authority in the Buddhist society and also in our monastery, and now here in front of you. And in those positions of authority, there's many different ways to actually to get the best out of people, to encourage people. And obviously encouraging faith, confidence and inspiration is by far the most efficient way to actually to get people to succeed in meditation or in monastic life or wherever. And it always brings to mind a very critical story in my monastic life, which is the story from the Chinese Art of War about the general in the Imperial Army who had the best discipline of all the troops. And the emperor asked that general, "Why is it that of all of the generals in my army, your soldiers always have the best discipline? What is your secret?" And of course, it's an important secret to know, because here in this meditation retreat, we're disciplining our mind. We're trying to get it to let go. We're trying to get it to watch the breath. We're trying to get it to meditate according to the instructions. And you all know the instructions, but why is it the mind won't do it? Why is it the mind is indisciplined from time to time? And this little story gives a lot of insight into why the mind is sometimes hard to discipline and why it's sometimes is easy to discipline. And the soldier, the general rather, told the emperor, "I always have perfect discipline amongst my troops because I only ever tell my soldiers to do what they want to do. When I tell them only what they want to do, that's why they always do it. If I told you what you wanted to do, you'd always follow orders. Why? Because I want to do it." And obviously, the deeper meaning of that enigmatic answer is that that general motivated and inspired those troops to have faith in that general, to have faith in what they were doing, to have confidence in their roles in the army. So much so that they wanted to get up early in the morning to train. They wanted to go into battle, even though it was painful. They wanted to go and serve in the same way that you are motivated to get up early in the morning. You get up even earlier than the bell, many of you, just like that Chinese general. I've motivated you somehow to want to get up in the morning. What the hell are you doing getting up 4 o'clock in the morning every day? Could you do that at home? Why do you do it here? Because you've inspired, you've had confidence, you've seen a reason for doing this. You sit many hours, sometimes in pain, you know, with your legs aching or your back aching. Why do you do this? Because you've inspired, because there's some faith and confidence there. Why do you watch the breath? For the same reason, hopefully. There's faith, there's confidence. So what that story was really pointing out is how to get discipline. It's not to be like the general who threatens, cajoles, and even punishes. You never get perfect discipline in the army that way. No way will you get perfect discipline in your mind if you force, cajole, and punish yourself. The best way to get perfect discipline in your life, as in an army, is actually to tell you what you want to do. In other words, to understand that doing this is for your benefit. That getting up early in the morning is conducive to progress, towards happiness, towards peace, towards freedom, towards liberation. That watching the breath is the best way to get happiness. And that if you allow the mind to wander all over the place, if you get into fantasies, if you just hang out and get into negativity, so if you realize the mind doesn't want to do that, because it recognizes that's not the way to freedom, to peace, that's just the way to more pain and more suffering. It's all about motivation, which is the job of faith. And motivation is the job of either the teacher or oneself or one's experience. The teacher tries to motivate by inspiring, either by example or by explanations. It's really good. It's happy to meditate. And again, motivating through happiness means that eventually that one recognizes that there is a possibility for me to realize what I've always wanted. It's for liberation, for freedom. As I've explained before, that the two types of freedom in the world, and again, it's such a deep teaching, this. It's the freedom from desire and the freedom of desire. So, when you're actually meditating, what particular freedom are you following? Are you allowing desire to run riot and falling away of freedom of desire? Or are you falling away of freedom from desire? And just letting go of those desires, those ill wills, those negativities, those wantings in the mind. And if you recognize which type of freedom you are following in this moment, in this minute, and you see that it's a freedom of desire you're following. I just want to do what I want to do. I want to go and think, want to fantasize, want to dream, want to eat, want to do this, do that. then I think you should realize, hopefully from the inspiration and motivation which you get from up here, that it's not going to be conducive to your happiness and well-being. It's leading in to contrary purposes. Just gets you more confused, more tired, more frustrated. The more one follows those desires and gives them sort of a free hand. So the motivation and the inspiration of faith, you know, comes from actually from listening, from experience, from being inspired, so that you want to meditate, you want to be in the present moment, you want to be silent, you want to be with the breath. At first that wanting has to come from a lot of belief, because if it's something you haven't experienced for yourself, you have to take it on board from the other people. And this is why that when we chant about the Buddha, Vijja Charana Sampanna is perfect in conduct and in wisdom. Just being perfect in wisdom is not enough, because you have to see those teachers and make sure that what they speak is what they do. That as they teach others, so they practice themselves. So not just perfect in wisdom, but they're also perfect in conduct. Their conduct is in line with their wisdom, with what they teach others. Because that's where we get inspiration and encouragement, to see that these teachings are able to be practiced. It's okay to be able to give an inspiring talk, but then if the monk, the nun, the teacher, whatever, goes off and just misbehaves, it doesn't give that confidence anymore. So one way we do get confidence, we do get faith, we do get inspiration, is controlling faculty, which inspires us to go for the deep states of meditation, for enlightenment, is actually to see those things manifested in others. To see it's possible, yeah. And also to see the results of those things, to see the happiness and the peace and the state of freedom in others. That gives you faith and confidence that it can actually work and it's worthwhile doing. So the job of the general is to motivate the troops by his own personal example, and maybe by citing the examples of others. Like in the question last night, to give some more examples of like the Kuba Rajans, the monks in our tradition, you know, who worked very hard in their meditation, but eventually broke through and became great monks and great teachers, so free and so happy. One of the reasons why I was kept in this tradition was the inspiration of seeing those monks in this tradition. I was very fortunate that, you know, the years when I was a monk, very long time ago, that there were still some of the great teachers who are now passed away many years ago. Some of these great monks who you went to live with and observe, and just to see how they did things. And of course one of the most inspiring things was to see how happy they were. It was a great relief to go and stay with someone like Ajahn Chah and to see just how he would tell jokes and be so light-hearted. And realize that wasn't just Ajahn Chah, that many other monks were also sort of great jokers and so light-hearted. And these were tough guys. These were tough as nails, but they had a tremendous sense of humor when it was time to laugh and joke. One of the famous Kuba Rajans, teachers in Thailand, was the monk called Ajahn Singthong, who was a joker. And even though that he was a disciple of Ajahn Mahabua, who is one of the fiercest and toughest of monks, still alive in northeast Thailand, Ajahn Mahabua could do nothing with the guy. The reason was because not only was a great joker, but he also had really strong meditation. The story they used to tell about this Ajahn Singthong is one morning he woke up late for the 3 o'clock morning meeting. And they knew he'd get into trouble with Ajahn Mahabua, he'd get blasted, maybe he'd get kicked out of the monastery. So just before arms round, this Ajahn Singthong, when he finally did wake up, went into the forest and grabbed hold of a forest chicken, got a rope, tied a rope around this poor chicken's neck and dragged it to the meeting hall with a squawking and squawking. Now the reason why he did this, because there's like an idiom in Thai about getting up early is actually arriving before the chicken. So when Ajahn Mahabua started blasting him, he said, "What do you mean? I came before the chicken." And Ajahn Mahabua shook his head and said, "Get out of here." when everybody laughed. He was like a joker. But Ajahn Mahabodhi could kick him out of the monastery, because even though that was his nature.
Yeah, when he came to meditation, just he was so good, so powerful. He just had joy in his meditation. And it had gave me inspiration that to see the finished product of, like, you know, the arahats, the great monks, the great nuns, it was inspiring. Because if I saw an arahat, an enlightened being, was really miserable, then I didn't want to be like that. So confidence, faith, actually came by seeing the finished products and saying, yeah, I want some of that. I want to be like that. And this is part of the encouragement of confidence. And once you have that confidence, you can see that you can have the ability to create energy. You have the motivation. And only with that motivation can there be actually success in a meditation. So that confidence that this is a path well worth taking. It's well worth finding out the skillful means so you can be in the present moment, be silent, watch the breath. Finding out the skillful means so you can get these incredibly powerful, wonderful, blissful images coming up and get into jhanas. And having the confidence and faith that from those jhanas you can actually cut off all attachments and be liberated and free to be an arahat oneself. And have the confidence and inspiration that's something really worthy of doing. Yeah, I want to be enlightened. Obviously, if you don't want to, there's no way you'll ever will. That's the first part of that inspiration, which arouses confidence, which comes from the beginnings of faith. But also, one has, especially in our Western world, has to also develop faith and confidence in one's own abilities. And this is one of the biggest hindrances which I come across as a teacher of meditation, a teacher of monks, is for people to think, well, maybe Ajahn Brahm's probably born in jhana, he probably came out of his mother's womb cross-legged. And it's probably, say, but me, poor old me, you know, I can't ever get these jhanas, you know, not me, I can't get such a light. And poor old me, I can't even watch the breath, I've been coming to these retreats how many years now, never got anywhere, not me, maybe everybody else, but not me. You see, that's that lack of faith and confidence in oneself. And that lack of faith and confidence in oneself is not going to help at all. In fact, it's a hindrance of self-doubt. And so we actually overcome that with that confidence and faith that I can do it. As me, so everybody else. As everybody else, so me. What's the difference between you and other people? Absolutely nothing. So when you actually understand the no difference between oneself and other people, it gives you the confidence, if they can do it, why not me? Sometimes that's why it's actually good when somebody gets a nice, say, jhana in a meditation retreat. I tell them, so-and-so's got a nice jhana today. They say, what, her? Well, she can do it, I can. And that sometimes gives you a little bit of encouragement that you can do it too. And sometimes some of the people, I told you the story, that little novice who got into jhanas. So a young 12, 13 year old novice can do these things. There's other people, you know, suddenly for one reason or another they press the right button and they get into these states. And my job is also to encourage you that yes, you can do it. If you haven't done it yet, that's what it is, not yet. It's not, no word for I can't. It's just I haven't done it yet. So you give yourself that confidence and encouragement. For example, that some years ago there was one man who was having very great difficulty doing the breath meditation. Could hardly watch the breath at all. Tried every different means to watch the breath, but just couldn't do it. He began to lose his confidence and faith in this meditation business. Maybe other people can do it, but I can't do it. And then a very skillful teacher came along and told him, said, well, look, don't try and watch the breath. Just imagine what it would be like to watch the breath. Just sit down there, close your eyes, and don't watch the breath, but just imagine what it would be like to watch the breath. Imagine watching the breath. So he thought, oh, this sounds crazy, but I might as well try it. So imagine watching the breath. Imagine the breath going in, imagine the breath going out, imagine the breath going in, imagine the breath going out. It was actually quite peaceful. And then the teacher interrupted him. What are you watching? The breath. He found he was watching the breath after all. Their imagination is just short-circuited his lack of confidence. He imagined he was doing it, and there was no difference between imagining doing it and really doing it. But when he believed he couldn't do it, then his imagination of what he could do and couldn't do meant he wasn't watching the breath. Can you understand how belief and imagination go hand in hand? So this is how we can, if you can't, haven't watched the breath yet, imagine you're watching the breath. If you haven't got into the present moment awareness, imagine what it'd be like to be in the present moment. If you haven't got an imitator yet, imagine an imitator. Imagine what it'd be like in jhanas. Imagine what it'd be like to be in mind. And you're quite close. So here, that faith in imagination, that could actually create sort of that clarity of what the goal is. The inspiration is very well worth achieving. And also, the faith in one's own ability to achieve these things. If ever you doubt your abilities, I'd always encourage you to read about the monks and the nuns in the time of the Buddha. And just how these were ordinary people. People which you can relate to. Especially go and read the stories of the naughty monks and the naughty nuns in the Vinaya. If you read about the naughty monks and naughty nuns in the Vinaya, there's always these rules of discipline. They start with stories of monks or nuns misbehaving. And when you read this, you can really relate to them. Because people haven't changed. It's one of the beautiful documents in history, this Vinaya Pitaka, because there you find ordinary people 25 years ago in a different culture acting just like human beings do today. For example, there was this group of six monks who were really the scallywags in the Sangha, very, very naughty monks. And one day there was, had this group of young monks called the group of 17 monks, friends who ordained when they were very, very young. And they found one of these group of 17 monks once, and all the six monks, they got hold of him, held him down and started tickling him. Even like monks would like play around like that, these naughty monks go tickling somebody else. And so after that the Buddha had to make a rule that monks aren't allowed to tickle anybody ever since that time. And just like they play around. And just one of my favourite stories in that Vinaya was of the nuns. So, I mean, you can imagine just we do this today. Whenever I say something's auspicious, you know, when it's sort of, it rains on a sort of, say, a Katina day, I say that's auspicious. You know, the heavenly beings are sort of crying out of joy. And when it's, the sun is shining, I say, isn't that auspicious? It's a lovely day today. In the time of the Buddha, there was a nuns' monastery in the city, and the nuns were staying in that monastery, and in the morning they didn't have sort of septic systems and wastewater treatment plants, so when they would get the stuff, the night soil, they used to call it, you know, the feces and other things from the night before, instead of actually throwing it in the compost, the rubbish place, one morning this nun threw it over the monastery wall just to get rid of it outside. Unfortunately, on the other side of the wall, unbeknownst to the nun, there was a man who was walking along in his best clothes, freshly washed, because he was going to the palace for an audience with the king. And as he was going past this monastery wall, this bucket of the most horrible, terrible stuff came over the wall, landed on his head, splattered his clothes. And he was justifiably quite annoyed, because it came from this nun's monastery. And he was not just annoyed, he was actually incensed. How could these nuns do this? And he started shouting about, you bunch of prostitutes, I'm going to teach you a lesson. And he went and got a torch and he went into this nun's monastery to burn the whole place down. And as he was going in there, he met one of the temple workers, this man. He said, what are you doing? said, these prostitutes, they don't know the right thing, the wrong things. These aren't real nuns. They just threw a bucket of excrement over the wall, landed right on top of my head. And this man said, really? That's auspicious.
When it comes to Buddhist nuns, it must be auspicious. It's like really holy water.
And just like these days, the guy bought it. He said, oh really, is it? He says, really auspicious. And that calmed him down. He said, look, go back home, get yourself changed again, and go back to the palace. You probably something really, really lucky is going to happen to you today. And so, yeah, instead of burning down the temple, because he thought this was suspicious to have excrement thrown on top of his head by a nun, he went back home, changed, got washed, he went to the palace, and the king gave him this really expensive, really unprofitable contract for the local city government. And so he went mad and said, wow, it's really, really auspicious to get things put up that. I wouldn't recommend that to a Dharmasara. But that actually is this is what happens in the time of the Buddha. It's just like people haven't changed in all those years, and so it gives you confidence and faith that just as they became enlightened, they weren't special people, they weren't supermen and superwomen in that time. They were just ordinary people like you and me. And so if they can do it, then we can do it. And it's marvellous also to get our confidence and faith by experience. So you do a little bit of meditation and you start to get a little bit of bliss. But sooner or later, you know, you start to meditate and the nimitta does come up to you, maybe only for a short time. Wow, even I can get these nimittas. You go and look at a carpet and wow, it's actually happening. It actually works. It gives you confidence. And then one day you press all the right buttons and you go to this beautiful bliss state of the jhanas. If you get into one of those jhanas, the confidence becomes huge. It's an inspiration. I tell people, if they've tasted a jhana, to go and read the Chulahatipadopama Sutta. This was the first sutta, the first teaching which the Arahat Mahinda gave to the people of Sri Lanka. The very first Buddhist teaching given to Sri Lanka. It gives the simile of the elephant's footprints. He said, like following like an elephant, trying to find out if it's a really big elephant or not, you have to just see the footprints of these things. And sometimes the footprints can be deceptive. Is this real tusk or not? But then in the sutta, they said that you can know the Buddha's footprints. What is a Buddha? They start to talk about the first four footprints of a Buddha. And this is why I usually tell people that, have you ever seen the footprints of the Buddha? Some people say that you can see the footprints of the Buddha on Adam's Peak, Sipada in Sri Lanka. They say no. Or there's a place in Thailand, Paputabat, which means like the Buddha's footprints. They say no, that's not where the footprints of the Buddha are. In this sutta, the first footprint of the Buddha is called first jhana. The second footprint is called second jhana. The third jhana, the fourth jhana. That's in the sutta, which was taught as the first teaching by the monks who went to Sri Lanka. And when I mention that, I say anyone who experiences jhana is standing in the footprint of the Buddha. You're standing there. You are experiencing what the Buddha experienced. Your mind in that state was the mind of the Buddha. That's why these things are incredibly powerful. They send shivers up your spine. This is actually how you visit the Buddha. And this gives you huge inspiration, huge faith. And that keeps you going for years and years and years and years. Empowering the meditation, empowering the practice. Which is one of the reasons why I spend a lot of my time teaching retreats, just to get people that first experience of that, you know, blissful nimitta. It's the first taste of a jhana, even though it's only what I call like yo-yo jhanas, just going in and coming out again straight away. even that's worthwhile, because that really encourages and inspires your faith. Or even just being able, just after maybe not a jhana, but at least a deep meditation, to ask yourself, what is my earliest memory? And to get either an early life memory, or to get a past life memory, or a memory of your time in your mother's womb. So that these experiences, which you can get on retreats such as this, actually affirm your faith in these teachings. Yes, there is such a thing as rebirth. I know, not because it says so in a book, not because my teacher says so, but because I know so, because I have remembered my past lives. You can experience your own past life, and then you know. And that solves a lot of problems there. That gives you that faith and that inspiration to empower you. That's why it's a controlling faculty. And you can see by such faith, by such inspirations, that's where you get your energy from. When you get disenchanted, disillusioned, frustrated, that sucks up all your energy. You've got no energy left. That's why the people who are disenchanted, disillusioned with the world, just are depressed. Got no happiness. So from faith we can actually get these huge sources of energy. You know, from even like confidence, inspiration. If I'm fortunate enough to give an inspiring talk, then people get inspired and energy, and they can sit very well. Now, if you get a little bit of experience in your meditation, wow, it's actually working, it's happening. I could do this. It's true, there are such things as jhana. It's true that you can see the flower become the most beautiful thing in the world. With that inspiration, you get this huge amount of energy. When I first read about these five controlling faculties and going into things like energy, I think I'm not sure if it comes from the commentaries, but it's certainly not from the suttas. Somebody started talking about balancing these faculties. You've got to balance faith with wisdom. You've got to balance energy with calm. And I actually bought into that for a while, until somebody pointed out quite correctly the Buddha never taught like that. You don't have to balance your energies. You don't have to lessen energy because sometimes you think it's too much. You can have as much energy as you want. There's no limit to the amount of energy which you can have, which is good and beneficial. The only problem comes that sometimes the energy, it's not that it's too much, but sometimes it goes into the wrong places. And it creates restlessness because it's going into the doer, not into the knower. So energy, you can't have enough energy. The more energy, the better. Heaps of energy. More energy, give me more. And you know energy just by the happiness, by the bliss. It's just that insight of energy, mental energy, is mental happiness. You get more and more energy, you get more and more bliss. More and more bliss, more and more energy. That's why when you're really blissed out, you can't sleep for days. You've got so much energy. Wow, this is really nice, really good. You don't need to. It's just nature. But the problem is, when you do get energy, like people have like strong cups of coffee or strong cups of tea, there's nothing wrong with a coffee or tea, but we don't know how to channel that energy. It just goes into thought, restlessness, worry, concern, planning. It should be going into the knower. Just passive awareness. So you're really bright and mindful and careful not to do things. So that's why sometimes people misunderstand the teaching which I give, and they say, you're not supposed to do anything, no energy, just be lazy, just sleep and just do nothing. I say, no, you're missing the point. It's not having, sort of doing a lot of things, and it's not doing. It's putting the energy into the knower, taking it away from the doer. Taking it away from controlling, manipulating, criticizing, thinking, managing, all that stuff of craving, taking the energy away from there and guiding it into mindfulness, knowingness, awareness. So when you hear, you're really hearing with everything you've got, full attention. When you're seeing it fully. When you're knowing it completely. Of obviously it's the counter conversation going on in your mind. You're not knowing. You're not really looking. You're not hearing. But when the mind is very still and all the energy is going into receiving the information of Dhamma rather than talking back at it, manipulating, changing it, only then can you really see deeply. And when you put more energy into the knowing, 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 it doesn't create restlessness at all. It's only when it overflows into doing things it creates restlessness and makes you all like the old simile says, like a chicken with its head cut off, running around, doing this, running around, doing that, never really happy, never really knowing what you're supposed to be doing, always on the move, always on the run, racing away, escaping, doing this, doing that, managing, solving problems, there's people's problems but not your problems. And that's just like the way of the world, the energy is going into the wrong place. You put the energy into passive awareness, into just knowing. It's the job of our meditation. And then you get heaps of energy. And that energy of the knowing, you can understand why that is a controlling faculty. Because you're seeing clearly what's happening. When you're seeing clearly what's happening, you can actually see what the problems are, you can see what you're doing. It empowers the third controlling faculty, mindfulness, which I was talking about yesterday. It makes mindfulness superpowered. That's how you meditate. That's how you get into deep meditations. That's how you find wisdom. The superpower mindfulness becomes the controlling faculty. It becomes like a supervisor. If you have a job in a factory, some task to perform, sometimes you have to have a supervisor. And what's the job of a supervisor? The supervisor is not to do the work. That's the job of the workers. The supervisor is to observe. And the supervisor has to know all the tricks of the workers. All the ways which they take days off because of sickies. That's what they have in Australia. Taking a sickie means you're not really sick, you just want a day off. Or the way that they, you know, carry pieces of paper around to look as if they're busy. It's the way that they sort of are on the telephone but not really doing any work. All the ways which workers try and get off doing their jobs. The supervisor knows all the tricks. And because the supervisor knows all the tricks, therefore he can make sure the job is done well, efficiently and on time. That's the job of mindfulness. Mindfulness is a supervisor of your mind. Knows all the tricks, the way you deceive yourself, so you waste time. So you don't really do the job of meditating. You don't really do the job of watching the breath. Because you know what happens sometimes is at a certain stage of the meditation the mind starts to get quite strong and you can actually think quite straightly for a while. And you start thinking about Dhamma. It's amazing when you get to a certain stage of meditation, you can give yourself this amazing Dhamma talk. Everything seems so clear and you say, oh, this means that, that means that, that means this. The Buddha called that a defilement. He called it the lingering defilement just before samadhi. You're missing the point. It's a trick of the mind. It's as if Mara, the person who's stopping you trying to get enlightened, you're just about to get to jhana and really see Dhamma. And he says, uh-oh, I'd better put out the last trick, which is actually to let you think about Dhamma. And thinking about Dhamma is not the same as knowing Dhamma. And people get stuck into that. They get to very, very close to jhanas and then they start allowing the thoughts to go around great, inspiring, profound Dhamma talks inside their own head. And they're just missing the point. They should have just shut up a bit more and they get the real Dhamma talk. It's just the pseudo, the false one. There's so many tricks of the mind. And supervise the mindfulness because it's superpowered. It sees, it looks, it remembers the instructions, it even remembers past experiences. And it gets really wised up to all the tricks of the defilements. Sometimes the defilements are very, very tricky. They say, all these like jhanas, it's just desire, desire, desire for achievement, achievement. I'm not going to get jhanas. That's just desire. I don't want to desire. We don't even aspire for things, and they settle for something much less. Just be ordinary, be ordinary, be ordinary, be ordinary. Don't be special. Remember this one monk who was practicing detachment to food. And so when he got his bowl of food one morning, so he looked in it, and he said, "That's attachment." He liked his food, so he pushed his bowl away and decided he wouldn't eat that day. And then he thought, "That's just pride." So he pulled the bowl to him again. And then he looked at the food and said, "That's attachment." He pushed it away. He was just pushing his bowl backwards and forwards, deciding whether it was pride or attachment, which was the worst. He's just playing around. That's just the mind playing its tricks. So mindfulness is very alert in a way, knows the tricks of the mind. The great supervisor, his job is not to do the work, it's the job of the mind, not to do things, but to know exactly what's going on. To know all the silly things you've done in the past, and the silly things you're doing now. Why you don't allow yourself to pursue deep meditation? Why you don't allow yourself to let go? All those little tricks of clinging on and justifying that clinging, thinking you have to do this and this is the right, when really you should know it's wrong. You know it's wrong because you don't get peaceful, you just don't get happy, you just give yourself a miserable time. No one else gives you a miserable time. No one else creates dukkha for you, you do. You create misery, you create dukkha. So when you understand that, the supervisor said, "Okay, stop your tricks, get to work, and then you get the great products of deep meditation, bliss, clarity, enlightenment." So mindfulness is a supervisor. And mindfulness as a supervisor enables you just to hold on to states of mind, to be still, to sustain attention on things. It's interesting, the ability to sustain attention. People have that, naturally. So I know some people who can watch a soccer match without moving for not only just for the 100 minutes but for extra time as well, even though they really have to go to the toilet. They just can't go to the toilet because somebody might score a goal. But I know other people, they can't sit on a meditation stool for more than 10 minutes before they have to go and do something. I know people who can watch movies all night but they can't sit still for more than an hour. As a young monk, I remember one monk who would be wide awake at parties all night. But when he became a monk and went to Northeast Thailand and had the all-night sits, 1 or 2 o'clock got very, very sleepy. That was me. Why did I get sleepy 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning? You know, when I was doing those all-night sits. When about a year before, I used to go to the all-night parties and all-night concerts, and I was never tired. When I listened to the Doors or Jeff's and Lever Pale from this party, I never got tired once. Maybe in the morning, maybe at 7 or 8 o'clock when you crash out. But why when I was meditating did I get tired? Why couldn't I sustain my attention? You know why? Because I was bored. I wasn't bored with the Doors. That was exciting, that was fun. I was bored with my breath. Breath going in, breath going out. I've been doing this for hours. And of course you realise that samadhi, the ability to sustain attention, sort of, it can't come from willpower. The reason why you can sustain attention on a soccer match, on a movie, on music, or on a party, is because you're having fun. And this is why Sukhino Chittang Samadhi, happiness, joy, is the cause for sustained attention. Which is why when I've given lots of skillful means for trying to develop happiness with the meditation. Breathing the wrong way around, breathing upside down, breathing a short in-breath and a long out-breath, or breathing a really short out-breath and a really long in-breath and changing it around, counting the breaths 1 to 9 and not 1 to 8, or counting them sort of up and down, whichever which way you wish. Thinking of a number and then count up to that number. Whatever it is, I mean, play around, make it fun, make it joyful. Because because that's actually the way you learn. That's the way you pay attention. With children, if you want a task to be done at school, you make the lesson fun and everyone pays attention. If you have food, make it fun, and then you're paying attention to what you're doing. Give a Dhamma discourse, you crack a few jokes, and people pay attention. You may give the most profound Dhamma discourse, but if it's not fun, then people fall asleep. But isn't it the case that you can sustain attention on things if it's joyful, if it's fun? So why is it when people start watching the breath, they can't keep their attention on the breath? It just wanders off and a thought comes in. When you go to the Dhamma, you don't know what's happened. Because there's no fun in it. That's the great trick of meditation, put happiness and joy in it. Just sit down there and just psych yourself up to have fun. We're looking upon this meditation as being just a game. Joy, happiness, fun. Make it pleasurable. Do it different ways. And when it becomes pleasurable and fun, it's so easy to do. You start off by putting pleasure in. That's part of the job of energy and faith and mindfulness. The supervisor, sometimes actually, remember this bricklayer at our monastery, he's always very lazy, always knocks off early and comes to work late. One day the builder wanted the job to be done quickly. So he said, I bet you can't finish this in 3 days. He said, yeah, I can. I'll give you a 12 pack of beer if you finish it within 3 days. Okay, you're on. And that was the only time when he worked really hard at our monastery. It wasn't actually getting the beer, he could afford the beer, it was like the principle of the thing. It became fun for him, like a challenge, something different. Now, I can't offer you a 12 pack of beer if you get into jhanas. So when you make it fun and enjoyable, then it's easier to sustain attention. So when you're meditating, please don't sort of fall into the old habit of I've got to sit for an hour, I've got to sit for 2 hours, I've got to sit this time. Don't get bored in this meditation retreat for this time. Make it fun. If you're getting dull and you can't hold the breath or whatever other object you're doing in here, go and sit out in the garden. Sit under a tree, sit in your room, sit in the toilet, anywhere, which makes it fun. Whatever you're doing. So make it interesting, make it strange, make it sort of like a bit of a challenge to you. And that way you find actually the ability to hold attention, sustain attention, is increased. Until it comes to the point that when you get the superpower mindfulness, just the same way from faith you get energy, from energy you get mindfulness. When you get superpower mindfulness, then you get the ability to sustain attention. Because superpower mindfulness sees happiness and beauty and fascination in anything. Just like a child can look at a piece of grass for an hour and just be fascinated by it. Or just like an old bottle top, because there's just so many gains, so much fun, so much enjoyment, so much in what to us would be just so ordinary and boring. But that degree of mindfulness which we've lost, that degree of mindfulness, we can hold our attention on simple things like the breath. And if we hold it on simple things like the beautiful breath, which is so lovely, then we can hold it on the nimitta, hold it on our own mind, without moving for long periods of time. And that really starts to become powerful. When you hold the attention, stillness starts to reverberate with energy. Power builds up, immense power. It wants to vibrate the whole thing, but that will just let the power go. It just holds it in absolute stillness. Get this huge, motionless power. That's what happens with samadhi. When you enter those jhanas, they're hugely powerful. Just like the power of 1,000 H-bombs, but they can't go off. They're just stuck there. Still. Bliss. This without moving. That's where wisdom comes from. The last of the controlling faculties. There is a sequential aspect of these faculties. From restraint, we get energy. From energy, we get mindfulness. From mindfulness, we get samadhi. From samadhi, we get wisdom. Seeing things as they truly are. We see things as they truly are. We see what happiness truly is. And how we've been satisfied unfairly with not a second class happiness, maybe a third or fourth class, it's way down the line happiness we've been satisfied with. We realize that the reason why we've only had that second, third, fourth class happiness is because we sought for it in the wrong way. Wisdom shows us that happiness is not out there in the next moment. It's not there in the next retreat. Happiness is not in the next lunch in a couple of hours' time. Happiness is not in the end of the retreat when you can go and do what you want. Happiness is not sort of when you retire. Happiness is not when you die and go to some heaven realm. How many people look for happiness in the future? Just get this retreat out of the way and then I can go do what I want. Just get today out of the way and then I can sort of, you know, then I can do what I want. Just get my life out of the way. How many of you are trying to get things out of the way? Study, get the studies out of the way. When I finish my exam, then I can really let loose. Get married. Once I get this, sort of all the, you know, the marriage and all this ceremonies out of the way, then we can really relax together. Then when I get the marriage out of the way, we don't like each other. When I get the kids out of the way, when I get my mother and father out of the way, it's stopping me becoming monks or nuns. It's always just when I get these things out of the way. When I get those of you doing the Waysack preparation, when I get Waysack out of the way, then I'll be happy. Have you ever noticed what you're doing all the time? Just happiness is always, always somewhere else. So you meditate to attain some happiness just at the end of the meditation or some lucky day when the paycheck comes. The paycheck is here now. Right in this moment, there's a paycheck. Pick it up, open it, spend it. It's a paycheck every moment. But we always think the paycheck's coming sometime later. This is why happiness is here in this moment. It's not on the next moment. It's not on the next meditation. It's not on the next retreat. It's not on the next life. Why we say, man, you become enlightened in this very life. In this very meditation retreat. In this very sitting. In this very moment. Now. So this is what wisdom shows us. That we go in the wrong direction to find happiness. That's called the arsenal, the outflowings of the mind. Thinking that happiness is out there. Get rid of this and get that, then I'll be happy. This is not what meditation says. Meditation is get rid of all that out there and have this in here. This is what you've got already. Let go. Abandon. Throw away all these desires, cravings, wantings, not wantings. And just come home. That's what wisdom tells you. It shows you where happiness truly is. Where enlightenment is. Where freedom is. Where peace is. Freedom from desires. Not the freedom of desires. Sometimes we think it's the freedom of the last desire. Just get that one last desire and then I'll be free. I was joking when I was in Singapore recently. But after the talks, people come up and say, just one last question. Just one last question. It's amazing just how many last questions there are. And I don't think the last questions are finished yet. When is the last question? When is the last desire? Make the last desire the one which was just gone a few moments ago. Not the one which is just coming. This is called freedom from desire. End it now. Well, I just have one more desire, please. One last question, then I'll shut up. Promise, absolutely. Shut up now. Let go now. So this is actually what wisdom says. Wisdom says that happiness is right here in this moment. Enlightenment is right here. In this moment. you've got a wandering mind, it's all over the place, it's depressed, it's upset, it just wants to leave right this moment, then please, if you're having a terrible time, please leave this retreat right now. But not through the door. Leave this retreat through your mind. Go into your mind, your wandering mind. Don't run away from it. Go into this moment. Don't sort of run off into the past or future. Go into this breath. Don't run away from it. If you want to leave this retreat, leave it through the door of the mind. So the Ananda, this beautiful simile. The Buddha actually is actually in one of the verses of this deva. He said, "The Buddha who discovered jhanas." I'll just mention that in just in the next film coming up. Sometimes people thought the jhanas existed before the Buddha, but it's actually in this verse that it said the Buddha discovered the jhanas. And that was actually taken up by Ananda in another discourse later on in the Anguttara Nikaya. What did he mean by discovered jhanas? And Ananda said, the first jhana is the escape, it's the whole out of the suffering of the body in the world. And the second jhana is that escape, is the escape hole, the breach in the wall from the suffering of first jhanas. Second is escape, third is escape from the second, fourth is escape from the third. And then eventually cessation, the ending of all things is escape from everything. It's a beautiful simile of how to leave the world through these holes in the prisons of the world. And then that's how to leave the retreat. So where wisdom lies, you run away for this moment. And the Buddha said it's just like the dog with mane. You run out from this retreat, out there into the world. You run from the world back into some ashram. You run from the ashram into some sort of relationship. You run from the relationship into some sort of fulfilling job. You fulfilling job to some other thing which you can do for the world. But you're never happy. Always got this itch called craving, like the dog with mange. Why? Because wherever you go, you carry it with you. The only way to escape from that mange, that itch, is to go in the opposite direction. Not run away from it, but run into it. Like being chased by a ghost. Chased backwards and forwards by this ghost called craving, called attachment. What actually is it? And one day, you stop and turn around and face that ghost and go BOOM! And then the ghost gets scared and disappears. That's what we'll be running away from, just a phantom. Eventually we stop and go in the opposite direction. We go in rather than on. And that's where we end all craving. That's where we end all suffering. That's where we get free. We experience that as bliss, the bliss of freedom. So these are the five controlling faculties. What is it? Faith, confidence, inspiration, energy, mindfulness, samadhi, sustained attention, and wisdom. And they are what power you along to Nibbana, power you into the jhanas, power you out of this world. That's where they're out of the world controlling faculties. So each one of those we cultivate. You can't cultivate enough wisdom, you can't cultivate enough samadhi, you can't cultivate enough mindfulness, you can't cultivate enough energy, you can't cultivate enough faith. Really get in there and go for it. Even inspiration, for those of you who've got the power of inspiration, just go down, bow down to a Buddha until you cry. Because what a Buddha stands for. So the emotions of pity, sukha, just really flow out. It doesn't matter how much they are, they're good. They're conducive to peace, to happiness, inspiration, to samadhi, to freedom, to wisdom. How much energy you have. Get that mind that's going so strong, so bright, you just meditate all night. Don't be afraid of that. Mindfulness, so sharp, it just sees everything, just such clarity. It's powerful, but don't be afraid of that power, you can't get enough. And samadhi, so still. Can't be too still. And then lastly, wisdom. See deeply. There's no end to wisdom. There's always different ways of seeing. different aspects of reality. That's why the Buddha said if he was living for 1,000, 10,000 years, he would still be able never to exhaust the different ways of explaining Dhamma. That's the extent of wisdom. Those are the five controlling faculties. So, get in there, build them up, give your meditation orb for your life orb, and then the meditation becomes fun and joyful and energetic. No, Krishnamurti, I think, was said that meditation is boring and makes you dull. He didn't understand what meditation was. Meditation doesn't make you boring, it makes you sort of joyful and playful. It doesn't make you dull, but it makes you full of energy, full of vim, full of zest. It's nature's cup of coffee. Okay, so that's the talk on the spiritual qualities. Any questions on that before I go off and do the interviews? Okay, one, well, yes. Go on. Okay, it's the spatial metaphor for what happens in meditation, in Dhamma. Because the other metaphor, sometimes you know what we mean by going in, by discussing this opposite, going on and out. We abandon or we pay no attention to this because the next moment is more important. So we want something in the future, or we're doing this to get something in the next moment. Pay attention to this for its own sake. We're meditating in this moment, for this moment, not to get something in the next moment. We're watching the breath just for the sake of watching the breath. We're walking just to walk. I'm listening to you just for the sake of listening, not to teach you anything or to get anything out of you. So we're going into this moment for its own sake, for its own purity, for its own wisdom. And we're going into the mind. Just too often that we say, okay, now I'm going to meditate, which means next month you're going to meditate. You aren't meditating now, shut up, just be. And always going into the moment. When you get like things which repel you, like you've got sort of too much wandering thought, you can't stop it. What actually happens, you know, what you're actually doing there is you want to have this moment where there's no thought. You're not actually accepting this thinking mind at the moment. You're not going into it, you're trying to escape from it. And that's why it doesn't stop. So, you heard me recently saying that when I was on my 6th-range retreat, stay by myself, I was having very great difficulty keeping my meditation together, having all these sort of thoughts and fantasies and plans coming into my mind, and it was a struggle to actually watch the breath. So I went up to the Buddha statue in this temple, because I had no other mind to talk to, and I made a resolution. I said in front of the Buddha statue, for the next couple of weeks, or whatever it was, that I am going to really try hard to watch the breath most of the day, but from 3 to 4, mind, if you want to think whatever you like, from 3 to 4 in the afternoon, you can think whatever you like. Sexual fantasies, plans, dreams, science fiction fantasies, whatever you want to do, you can do it from 3 to 4. That's your free time. And there's no rules. Go for it. But for the rest of the day, you watch the breath. That's the deal, okay? So I tried that. But all the day, it was still a struggle. I tried to watch the breath, and my mind would wander off. You know, sensory desire, ill will, all the hindrances coming up, one after the other. Sometimes they gang up on you. You know what it's like. And then I struggled. When it came to 3 o'clock, I sat down, I put my legs out, leaned against the wall, and said, okay, whatever you want to think about now. No holds barred. And you know what happened? I just watched the breath for the next hour, just so easy. It's amazing for the psychology. I had to find that out just from experience. But you understand what was going on. What the heck's going on? Why is it when I really am trying, I'm really putting forth effort, I'm really trying to watch the breath, and I can't do it, and all this other rubbish is coming up. But as soon as I say, okay, whatever happens, you know, just come in. Why is it I'm watching the breath for an hour without any problem? And that, you know, gave you a lot of wisdom there. It's because I was always going on to something else, trying to get rid of things. That's why I could stay with the breath. It's going in the wrong direction. I didn't realize how I was creating so much disturbance for myself by trying so hard, by controlling. And then I just let go for an hour. It doesn't matter, whatever comes, comes. When I let go, the breath came, I was still. I wasn't actually fueling that restless mind. And that's what happened to Ananda as well. Just before he became enlightened, the Buddha had already passed away. There was a great meeting of 500 monks. All these 500 monks were all enlightened monks with great powers except for one, that was him, Ananda. He was like the odd one out. You know what pride is like. Now imagine that if I said that the 50 people in this meditation retreat, 49 were fully enlightened already, and you're the only one still. How do you feel? That's how Ananda felt, only 10 times. It was 500. 499 were enlightened, he was the only one who wasn't. So that night, as the last night, was really go for blood. He tried so hard. Really meditating all night. Trying to watch the breath, whatever he was doing. Really putting forth all the effort. He'd been with the Buddha for so many years. He knew all the tricks. He put all everything into place, but he only knew them superficially. And when he got to dawn, when the sun came up, he was as stupid as when he just started. Not in mind at all. And that's when he gave up. And according to the story, it's a beautiful story, he decided just to take a few minutes rest before the meeting. And before his head touched the pillow, he was fully in mind. That's how quickly it happened when he really let go. He went into things rather than on. What letting go does. It goes in the opposite direction. Okay, so I think that's enough because I'm in trouble again. I'm 10 minutes late for the interviews. So, those who are on the interviews this morning, you know who you are. So please, if you'd like to come into the room next door for the very...